The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from West Babylon, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. I'm Bill Donahue. I'll be taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 14th day of May, Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to all our moms out there. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is across the way. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in the legendary singer-songwriter, Don McLean. And in the second half, we'll speak to senior baseball writer for ESPN.com, Keith Law, will join us, and we'll talk about his new book, Smart Baseball. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on GBB. Got some great stuff ahead in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by and give us a look, and then you can give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest is an iconic singer-songwriter, famous for many memorable songs, most notably, of course, the classic American Pie. He'll be in our area performing at the Suffolk Theater in Riverhead on July 22nd. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Don McLean. Don, good evening.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Great to have you with us, Don. Now, some of your early musical influences, who would you count among those?
Oh, gee. Well, certainly the early rock and roll guys like Buddy Holly, Elvis Presley. Believe it or not, I loved all of the black rock and roll groups, the Flamingos, people like that. There were guitar influences, like later on in folk music, Josh White and Pete Seeger were influential, certainly. Also, the guitarist with the Weavers, a man named Fred Hellerman.
Yeah.
I think a lot of guitar from him. And Brownie McGee is another guitarist I learned a lot of guitar from, because I would spend summers in Lenox, Massachusetts, and usually as an opening act to Brownie McGee and Sonny Perry, and have a lot of time to sit around and play guitars. I learned a great deal from those people.
Outstanding. Well, you're an Iona Prep guy.
Yes, I am. I enjoyed that very much, and at the same time, I belonged for a brief while to Oriana Beach Club, which was had a lot of Iona students were members there, and did a lot of hard work on the swimming team for 5 or 6 years. So I was getting into it pretty good there in the Neuchâtel where I came from. But I got involved with a thing called the Hudson River Sloop, up on the Hudson, and it became a passion for me. And when I graduated from college, I graduated from Iona College.
Right.
1968 with a bachelor's degree in business and a minor in philosophy. And I went up the Hudson and started to sing with Pete Seeger on the Hudson River.
Talk to us a little bit about Pete, a real legend in music and very underrated, I feel. Give us a little insight into what working with Pete was like, Don.
He was a guy who wanted to use music as a means of getting people to think about stuff, whether it was the environment or war or civil rights or whatever it was. And he was a lightning rod for criticism because he'd been a communist. And he was blacklisted in the 50s. And so that, I saw the, even in 1968, I saw the effects of that. You know, people were still after him and picketing and angry about him, his political beliefs, mm-hmm. and such as they were, I mean, it's hard to pin his political beliefs down. I was never all that interested in that. I was more interested in how he, you know, frailed the banjo or what he did on a 12-string guitar.
Right.
He didn't care about what he thought politically. I was always trying to figure out how he did such and such, you know.
Sure.
And watching him work, he was a past master at coaxing an audience. He was a very, what you might say, a seductive performer. He wasn't a great singer, but he was a wonderful instrumentalist, and he knew how to choose the right songs and put them in the right order, and he didn't do the same thing every night. And that's one thing I took from him. I never, ever do the same show every night. I always change. And he used to say, you know, have idiomatic mastery. Master your idiom. Don't be wedded to a set list. You have to go out and sing the same set every night. Because that's really not what this is all about. So I really worked at that.
Interesting. Yeah, a great man in his own right, definitely. Now, one point I wanted to bring up, Don, is there's a fraternity brother of mine lives in Saratoga Springs. We know that you played at Cafe Alina up there. We want to bring up the point about the tin and lint, that American Pie was written in a booth in the old tin and lint up there. And I heard you refuted that in a New York Times article.
Nobody's buying that, but
yeah.
So I don't want to say anything else.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sorry, but you know what? I'm going to be 72 this year. And
right, God bless.
You know, my memory is not as good as it was, so it could be something to it, but I don't think so.
Yeah. Okay, all right. I'll let him know that. He's probably listening right now, definitely.
Uh-huh.
Now, you and Pete went up and down the Hudson performing, as you said, on his Clearwater boat trip, raising awareness about the environment. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's what was going on. In 1966, I discovered that he was starting this the germ of this idea, and he had a little show in Garrison, New York. I'd never been to Garrison. I lived in New Rochelle.
Right.
And never really went up the Hudson. My grandmother was a Hudson River girl. She'd been born in Red Hook, New York.
Oh, Red Hook, yeah, near Rhinebeck, yeah.
That's correct. And so she had relatives up there, and once a year maybe we'd take a trek up to Poughkeepsie or Rhinebeck or somewhere. It just seemed like a long way away to me, and I never knew where it was. So I discovered the Hudson Highlands. That was a tremendous thing that day in 1966. And then I saw him singing away there in front of a few hundred people, and they were talking about this sloop. And so anyway, to make a long story short, what happened was it got built in 69, and then in 70 and 71, I became extremely famous, and I was able to do appearances, you know, in addition to my schedule, which at that time was backbreaking, to raise money for the boat, which I loved. I loved the idea, and I had been one of the initial singers, so I sailed the boat down from Damariscotta, Maine, where it was launched, or whatever they call it, and into New York Harbor at South Street. So it was great. I was always around these interesting people. And I will tell you one thing for folks out there listening. Again, I am not either left-wing or right-wing. I'm an American, and I take a little from column A and a little from column B. But when they talk about the global warming thing, 40 years ago, there were scientists that would give talks before the show would start when we would come out and sing, and they would say exactly what was going to happen in 30 or 40 years, and that's exactly what's happening. So either they were, you know, had very good science, or they were really good predictors.
Psychics, yeah.
So there's really something to it. I firmly believe that. So what we would do in the beginning was a really interesting grassroots thing. The boat would pull up, let's say, what Pete Seeger wanted was to get people down to the banks of the Hudson River and then clean the river up, a big task because the government really didn't care at all about it. It was sort of a sewer for a lot of businesses that were located around there. And so, anyway, the whole thing started building, and there was scientists and writers and artists and singers and people that would turn up, and it was very, very interesting and vibrant. And so for a little guy like me who had just gotten out of college, you can imagine what it was like. And the boat would be there, and sometimes we would, a bunch of us kids, you know, would chop a pathway down to the river, and then they'd put a little float down there, and they'd run some electricity with a generator, and we'd put on a little show, and people would come down to the river's edge and, you know, congregate around our little improvised stage.
Nice.
So this was the whole idea, to stop the highways and all from preventing people from enjoying the river. He accomplished those goals. The river is a clean river, and people have pretty good access to it now.
Exactly, yeah. You're exactly right. Got Don McLean with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. A real pleasure to have him with us. Now, talking about American Pie, it's a really a sprawling ballad. It's inspired by the deaths of Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and the Big Bopper, correct?
Yes, and there was a book written called The Buddy Holly Story, which was written after American Pie came out. And I was honored by the writer who wrote me a beautiful letter, and he said that he'd been trying to get that book out for 2 years and that no publisher was interested. But after American Pie came out, suddenly there was a good deal of interest in not only these three artists, but also all this beautiful music from the 1950s and 60s before the so-called British invasion, you know, when Elvis was king and all these great songs were on the charts. So American Pie, interestingly enough, paved the way for Buddy Holly to then have the book come out. And from the book came the movie, and the movie catapulted him to where he should have always been and changed everything. And then a lot of stations turned out to be, decided to become, I should say, oldie stations and play this kind of music. So it kind of was a foreshadowing of bringing all that stuff back again.
Definitely, yeah. The song recorded May 26, 1971, started getting played on stations that are gone now that we remember fondly from our youth, WNEW FM and WPLJ.
Right.
And
right.
They used it to mark the closing of the Fillmore East. But there was a gentleman by the name of Bob Dearborn who unraveled the lyrics and published his own interpretation. What did you think of that?
Well, I didn't. I thought he was just kind of what would be the word? He was sort of co-opting what I did and coming up with something. I don't think, you know, I never thought about it. There were a lot of people who said things about the song's lyrics, but the reason that I never. By the way, he was I think out in Chicago with a major station out there.
Yeah, what was it? It was WCLF. Yeah, WCFL.
Yeah, so I think that was a fun thing for them. You know, they got a lot of mail and stuff like that. But as far as the song's lyrics go, I always tried to keep the poetry, so I never really talked about the song that way. You know, like this person's that and that person's this, because it's really a dream, and one thing can sort of morph into another.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds about right. The song was voted number 5 in the poll of 365 songs of the century by the RIAA. Such songs, folks, that I'm sure you recognize, like Over the Rainbow from The Wizard of Oz, White Christmas, This Land is Your Land from Woody Guthrie, Respect, and there's American Pie at number 5.
Well, it's a good list for me, that's for sure.
Sure. Now, the manuscript, too, that you wrote out, Don, it sold for over $1 million.
That's correct.
Unbelievable. Did you ever think anything like that would come to pass?
No, I never thought I'd amount to much, to tell you the truth. And most everybody agreed. They thought I wouldn't amount to much either, because I quit school in 1964, and all my friends that I knew went on, you know, to continue on and sort of left me behind. And I was madly in love with music, and my father had died when I was 15, and I didn't have any reason not to follow my dream, but I really wasn't a dreamer. I was a person who had goals.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great to dream, but it's important, you know, even like an athlete, you want to dream about being the best, but you have to have goals.
Right.
And do the workouts and improve and so on and so forth. So it's the same in my game. So I had things that I wanted to accomplish. And as the time went by, slowly, I began to accomplish these things. The first thing, of course, was getting involved with Seeger. And there's a lot of people who saw me, and one guy saw me. Named Robert Elstrom, and he made a feature film about me before I was even on a record. And the film's called Till Tomorrow, and he followed me around for about 2 years.
Wow.
Swedish tech. And a lot of that, pieces of that are on YouTube. You can go way back almost 50 years on YouTube and see me go from a young boy to an old guy.
Interesting,
and,
yeah.
After that, the first album came out, and that was a big game changer, because then I started getting played a lot on underground radio, and then the second album put me on the charts and made me world famous.
That was American Pie, folks. The first album of Don's is called Tapestry, and contained songs like Castles in the Air. Your third album, I remember I got it on 8-track tape. The Don McLean album, where you're on the cover by the town of Cold Spring, upstate New York.
Right.
Had it on 8-track tape. I got it from the Columbia Record and Tape Club, which nobody ever fulfills their obligation to the Columbia Record and Tape Club, right, Don? So I still owe them about $40, I think. They're probably still on the trail looking for me. Yeah, nobody ever pays that off. When you get 12 records and tapes for a dime or whatever it was.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you a funny story about that. There were two songs on that record, a song called Dreidel.
Dreidel, right.
And a song called If We Try.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of other songs that people like, because a lot of people bought that record. But one of the great things was that when I first went out to Los Angeles to sing, I mean, I was really all on my own, and I used to carry three instruments, like blocks and blocks, down to the Troubadour every night, and then back early in the morning, 1 in the morning, you know, after the shows, for 2 weeks. And I do this frequently. I was in pretty good shape in those days. And, you know, I was basically really struggling, like so many people are in California and Hollywood. And by the time that album came out in 1972, I guess it was the end of 72, I played a concert in Los Angeles, and there was a big billboard, enormous billboard, with a cover of that album on it. And so that's the kind of success story you can have in America.
Definitely, yeah. Now, you had some success, Don, in the UK when they weren't playing your records over here. I read that you were on Top of the Pops. I used to watch that as a student over in London. What do you attribute your success to the UK and Australia?
Well, I really made an effort to tour there immediately. They liked me. They liked, I think the record company over there was more committed to me and my music and my albums, so that the first probably 10 albums I released were were either gold or platinum in Australia, and of course, even as late as the late 80s, The Best of Don McLean was number one, and number one in England, and I had Crying was number one in those all around the world, and through Europe came back to the United States and became number four or five in the United States in the early 80s.
Now, Roy Orbison paid you some great tribute for that version of Crying. Also, you got some nice remarks from Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys. Pretty high company there.
I love both of them. I'm a huge Beach Boys fan. In fact, their tour a few years ago with all the original people was probably one of the best shows I think I ever saw. It was just, and I know a lot of those guys now, and I was backstage, and I was also able to see the around front, and God, there was so many hits and such great American music. I mean, these guys actually just created this whole genre of cars and beach and all that didn't exist before then. It's like the Sons of the Pioneers created Western music almost, you know. Of course, they were Western folk songs for sure, but they created a genre too. And I mean, there's just so little of that. You know, you have to give it a tremendous amount of credit. And, of course, the same thing in a way with Roy Orbison, who, you know, created a whole dark, lonely kind of a persona, and certainly had a hell of a lot of tragedy in his life. You know, he lost his son, he lost his wife in a motorcycle accident, and, you know, he carried on. But I was noticing the other day, I was listening to You've Got It, which I just love. I love that tape, and I love the way he sings it, and I love that song. It was his comeback. He was only 52. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, that was the Traveling Wilburys tune, right?
I don't know. Maybe it was, or maybe it was a little later. When he made a comeback on his own, which was huge. And I think that he sold, I'm not sure about this now at all, but I think that there was a big publishing deal that allowed them to put money into his career, and he lost weight, and he looked great, and had this super song, You've Got It, and God, it was just, but I'll tell you, I was with him one night, and those guys lived on fast food out there on the road. That's the one thing I noticed. And he was pretty heavy at the time that I was with him, about 1980. And this is just 7 or 8 years later, and he had just had open heart surgery, I think, in the late 70s. So he was not sticking to the right kind of, not that I do, but I mean, he wasn't sticking to the right kind of diet.
Yeah, that's unbelievable now. What are you keeping busy with these days, Don? I know you're touring. You'll be in our neck of the woods in July. Any new projects happening?
Well, I've got a record deal going with BMG Records, and they're going to come out with an album of all new songs that I've done. It's been sitting on the shelf for a while because they've been dragging their feet, and it's called Botanical Gardens.
Okay.
And so we hope that will come out at the end of this year, near the end. And I'll be promoting that and touring behind it and probably go overseas, you know, and do a lot of shows. So I'm still doing exactly what I've always done. You know, I've never really had any kind of mechanism behind me, you know, to get these kinds of awards and things that people get, but I've been definitely paid attention to from time to time, and I've had some wonderful experiences with my music. Amazing things.
Well, it's certainly well-deserved, Don. I'll tell you, it's been an honor and a pleasure speaking with you tonight, Don. We could go on and on. I realize there's so many other things I wanted to get to, but I thank you for taking part out of your Sunday night to be with us.
Terrific. Happy Mother's Day.
to everyone. Yes, Don. And once again, Don will be appearing out at the Suffolk Theater in Riverhead Saturday evening, July 22nd. You take care, Don.
Alrighty, thank you very much.
Don McLean, folks. Next up, we'll talk to ESPN writer and author Keith Law, and we'll talk about his new book, Smart Baseball, so stay with us, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240 on Long Island's AM 1240. WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit Gustbuster.com and get your Gustbuster today.
Stay connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, folks, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue with you on this Mother's Day Sunday evening. Derek Jeter ceremony at Yankee Stadium where he's getting his number retired tonight. Mets with an absolutely gut-wrenching loss in Milwaukee. Had a 7-1 lead, coughed that up, and things are really hitting the skids for the New York Mets. But, Mom, I hope you enjoyed your day out there, and everybody's having a very pleasant evening. My next guest grew up in Smithtown. He's a senior baseball writer for ESPN.com, formerly a writer for Baseball Prospectus. He's also worked in the front office for the Toronto Blue Jays. He's a member of the Baseball Writers Association of America. His new book is titled Smart Baseball, the story behind the old stats that are ruining the game, the new ones that are running it, and the right way to think about baseball. I welcome to the show tonight Keith Law. Keith, good evening.
Good evening.
How are you, sir?
I'm good, thank you. How about you?
Outstanding. It's great to have you with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
If you would, Keith, give us your impression of the season thus far in baseball. Not too many great teams hanging around, but there have been some interesting moments so far.
Well, I always tell readers of mine who, you know, I do weekly chats on my site, and I obviously write a lot for ESPN. I always tell them, don't get too worked up over anything till about mid to late May. We're starting to get to that point now.
Yeah.
But even, I mean, I did a radio hit in St. Louis in late April, and they were in full-on panic mode. And now they're barely in first place. But they are in first place. They've salvaged their entire season in about 2 weeks.
Right.
When everyone was just about to jump off the bridge, now they're all in and celebrating a series win over the Cubs and thinking it's great again. So there's so much left to be played. Eric Thames was the hero of the National League the first 2 weeks. In the last month, he's just been fine. He hasn't been terrible, but he hasn't kept up the torrid start. So I always try to not overreact to anything that happens in tiny samples because we have so much baseball left to be played. And a lot of the things that look meaningful today will even out over the rest of the season.
I hope you're right, Keith, because I'm on the bridge right now.
Because of the Mets?
Yes.
Okay.
Someone's going to have to talk me down, sir, because they're going to Arizona. The Diamondbacks have been playing fairly well. Things don't look good. And Eric Thames, we saw him this weekend with the Brewers. I keep on calling him Eric Thames.
Right, yes.
I just can't get used to
Marcus
that.
Marcus was a river in England?
Yes.
Yes. I do it, too. I did it on air a couple of
did
weeks
you?
Ago.
Yeah.
Because I keep, because I'm thinking it's the river, right? I mean, absolutely. And before Marcus, like if you watched any of my parents were, they watched PBS 13 all when I was growing up. So did I, of course. But I remember them having, you know, Masterpiece Theater and Mystery on. And, of course, it's the Thames. It's the River Thames.
Exactly.
So see that spelling. That's what I want to say.
What else would it be, right?
Right.
Exactly.
He says, he says his name wrong and someone has to correct him.
Right. Now, why this book and why now for the concept, Keith?
The book, readers had been asking me for years to recommend something to them so that they could get up to speed on sabermetrics or on advanced stats, for whatever the reason was. Something had prompted them to say, I want to learn more. And there wasn't really a book written for the lay audience that covered what I wanted a book like that to cover. If I was going to recommend something, it had to be something I'd read and liked myself. There were more advanced books out there. There were books that talked about the history of stats in baseball, but there wasn't anything that actually walked through and said, here's why these old stats are just not very useful for talking about players. Here are some other stats, some basic, some less basic, a little more complex, that tell a better story and that will allow you to discuss player value just at a higher level, maybe along the lines of the way that teams are looking at players now. And then I wanted to sort of look a little bit forward at the end, because as I was writing the book, Major League Baseball was in the second season of using this StatCast data. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a perfect way to wrap things up and say, here's the next thing that we're seeing, is the next kind of data. Let me at least introduce it, knowing full well that in 5 years there will be things out of that data that we've learned that we can't even imagine right now.
Now, you began writing for Baseball Prospectus back in 97, but unlike many of the people who wrote for that publication, your primary influence was not the legendary Bill James, but a gentleman by the name of Eddie Epstein.
Who ended up, he was ended up writing for Stats, which obviously was connected to Bill James early on. Eddie wrote a book on prospects, the minor league guys, where he would talk about prospects primarily from a statistical, using his own proprietary statistical formulas that he would also use when working with clubs. He consulted for several clubs over the years. He might still, actually. And he spoke about players in a way I had never heard before, that dovetailed with some of the things I had learned online while I was in college and first kind of had access to the online sabermetrics community. And bringing those two things together especially allowed me to, again, just view baseball through an entirely different set of lenses, totally a 180 from what I had grown up thinking about player stats. And so that just encouraged me to keep learning more and eventually to try my hand at writing myself, although I will say even today I still think I'm learning as I'm writing. There's so much depth to what we can do with baseball stats, and it's constantly changing. So
yeah.
I feel like the job is a never-ending challenge.
You're right, definitely. Now, you were hired by the Blue Jays as a consultant to baseball operations. You worked with J.P. Ricciardi, Paul D. Podesta. Tell us a little bit about your time with the Jays.
So I was hired to be essentially the stats department. Ricciardi had gotten the job as GM. He came from Oakland, where he worked with Billy Beane, with Paul D. Podesta. Dave Forst was there at the time. J.P. really couldn't bring many people of his own over to Toronto, and through some connections, I knew Paul, I knew Billy, and I got to know JP, and he asked if I would come. He said essentially be his Paul D. Podesta, which really meant someone to handle just really collecting the stats. I was probably spent more of my time actually gathering information, because at the time a lot of it was not easy to come by. So I would say I spent more of my hours on the job gathering information and getting it into forms where we could query it or we could look at it, we could filter it, rather than doing the kind of heavier weight analysis that is more common in baseball ops departments now. And while I was there for 4.5 years, I also realized I only had one tiny sliver of the whole puzzle. and was very fortunate to work with some guys who I credit in the acknowledgments who helped me learn about the scouting side of tennis, which is how this opportunity at ESPN opened up for me and why I ultimately was able to leave and do something that was a little more family friendly and obviously had more job security than most front office jobs will give you.
Sure. All right. Now, while doing my research for tonight, Keith, I ran into this piece where you got into it a little bit on Twitter with Curt Schilling, which is not a difficult thing to do.
No.
Knowing the volatility of Curt Schilling and his viewpoints. Tell us a little bit about that.
So Curt, and Curt and I were very friendly while he worked for ESPN. I worked with him face-to-face a lot. And I respect him a lot when it comes to talking about players, especially talking about pitchers. But he was a creationist. He is a creationist. He was arguing against evolution on Twitter. And it's funny, I had just gotten home from vacation. And, you know, I sort of saw that and said, well, this can't abide. And just pointed out to him that he's wrong. This is not an open question. Evolution is settled science. There is certainly a lot about the mechanics of evolution that scientists are still learning and questioning, but there is no question that evolution is it. I think the quote from Richard Dawkins is the greatest show on earth and the only game in town. This is it. This is how we got here. We're just disputing the actual process or mechanics or parts of that. So for Curt to be espousing what I would consider a blatantly anti-science view, I was not going to sit by and just let him preach that without any real opposition.
Excellent. Excellent idea. We got Keith Law with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, you're a member of the Baseball Writers Association of America, Keith. You vote for the Hall of Fame, then?
I have two more cycles before I get there. You have to be a bad
member. Okay.
Ten consecutive years. So not this winter, but the following winter, then I will have my first ballot.
Okay. Do you think you'd ever abuse the privilege, what I call the privilege, of voting for the Hall of Fame the way some of these guys do, handing in a blank ballot?
Oh, never.
Voting for Kenny Lofton, you know, things like that.
I view it as a privilege and a responsibility.
Definitely.
Because I've voted for postseason honors since 2009, I believe, was my first one. Usually they give me Rookie of the Year because I'm a prospect guy, and that's fine. You know, I always say to them, we don't have enough voters for the annual awards. I said, you just give me what you need me to vote for. Fine. Like, it would be wrong for me to complain because, again, I view it as a privilege and an honor. And I always publish my ballot with a full explanation so that, because I view that as an obligation of the job. And I have told readers for a while now, when I get to my first time voting for the Hall of Fame, I will publish my ballot. I will explain it in full. And even for the past few years, I have typically given, here's my hypothetical ballot. If I had one, here would be my 10. And that gives viewers, readers a chance to sort of argue back and make the case for other players. And they usually raise things I've already thought about, but I want them to understand that I'm willing to be transparent about this because I do take it very seriously.
Yes, definitely. It is a great responsibility, Keith. Taking a look inside the book now, Smart Baseball by Keith Law, some of the talking points that I recognized were 2015 National League batting race between D. Gordon and Bryce Harper. Let's talk a little bit about that.
I used that as a way to demonstrate why batting average is just woefully incomplete as a measure of the hitter. You know, the language of baseball is if you lead your league in batting average, you win the batting title and you are the batting champion. But you're not the best hitter. You led in one particular fairly narrow category. And you look at the difference between those two players. D. Gordon, fine player, but a singles hitter.
Mm-hmm.
That's as little power as you're going to see in a full-time player. Bryce Harper that season had a year for the ages where he had tremendous power. He drew a ton of walks. D. Gordon's not much of a not a particularly patient hitter either. Power and walks are just not included in batting average. So if you looked strictly at batting average, you'd say, well, D. Gordon had the better season. But if you look at the stat line as a whole, you would see that there's a huge gap in performance between the two. Bryce Harper was a far better player on the order of magnitude of several extra wins that he created for his team just with his bat. And so I wanted to use that as I was looking for a particularly stark recent example where somebody won the batting title but was nowhere close to the best hitter in his league. And I was fortunate enough that there was one basically sitting right in front of me from the previous season.
Right. But you're definitely correct. Dee Gordon, a singles hitter. Bryce Harper, a triple crown threat, really. We can see with the contract he just signed how valuable he is to the Nationals. We'll see how much he makes in after 18 and who he signs with, as a matter of fact. But a very good point made right there. Now, the 2016 Major League playoffs, highlighting how managers use their best relievers incorrectly.
Yes, and we got correctly and incorrectly last postseason, so it worked out beautifully. Incorrectly, the example I keep going to is the AL wildcard game where Buck Showalter, ordinarily a pretty good manager of bullpens, left Zach Britton in the pen, standing on the bullpen mound, waiting for a save situation that never came. He essentially managed to the stat. Rather than managing to win, which would have said, you don't lose this game without your best reliever throwing probably two innings for you, just to extend the game, give your offense a chance to score a couple more runs. Instead, he went to arguably his worst reliever, and then a starter who was only in the bullpen because he wasn't good enough to make the playoff rotation. And that latter guy, Ubaldo Jimenez, gave up the home run that ended their season, again with Britton standing on the mound. Contrast that to Joe Maddon, Dave Roberts, and especially Terry Francona taking their best relievers and using them much earlier in games, throwing the save stat and save situations completely out the window and bringing in those relievers to get critical outs in high leverage situations, potential turning points in the game where getting the next out or the next few outs was most critical to their chances of winning. That's how you manage a modern bullpen, even though it really would fly in the face of the last 30 years of bullpen management.
Yeah, right. Wonderful point again, Keith. Now, having tackled the wrong way of viewing things, you illustrate the proper stats in which to evaluate players. Delve into that a little bit for us.
And so I try to give a number of different stats that are just better. I give some better offensive stats, and I start with on-base percentage, which still, all the basic stats that you might have heard of 20, 30 years ago, I keep saying what was on the back of the baseball card. There were good numbers there. We just didn't use them as much. On-base percentage, to me, is still the best of them. It measures one fundamental thing, the most fundamental aspect of the hitter's spot. Did he get on base or not? Did he make an out? That's what it's telling you right there. How often does he make an out? 300 on-base percentage, 70% of the time he makes an out. That's not very good. He better be pretty good at defense.
Right. Now, you bring up Andre Dawson as far as an example.
Yes. And he was a useful one because in 87, he won the MVP in the National League on a last-place team, too, which was controversial in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm saying in the book, he basically won because he had the hard home run and RBI titles for the National League. But his on-base percentage was low, and it was low for his entire career. He was never an on-base guy. But it turns out Tony Gwynn was a much more valuable player that year because he got on base at a far higher clip and hit for a little power and added a lot of value on the bases, too. But the biggest difference between him and Dawson was how often they got on base. And it turns out a lot of the time you're looking for differences in value between two players. The first place you should look, and the place you're more likely to find, I think, the biggest gap of all, is in the on-base percentage and how frequently they're making outs. And if you look at on-base percentage and then a measure of power, and I discuss slugging percentage and then later in the chapter talk about the more advanced stats that try to combine them, those are the two things that really distinguish hitters. And if you read any of my writing at ESPN, for folks who haven't, I'll often just give those three rate stats, batting average, on-base percentage, slugging percentage, with slashes between them. We call that the triple slash line for a hitter. And that's a quick and dirty way of giving you a fairly complete picture of a hitter's performance using only basic stats. So there's more advanced stats, and I go all the way up to wins above replacement in the book. But I still do like to rely on some of the older ones that still have some value and that are familiar to everybody because I think accessibility is important. If we only speak in terms of advanced stats, we run the risk of cutting off a portion of the audience. And I don't favor that kind of exclusivity. I want my writing to still feel inclusive.
Mm-hmm. Fine. Now, Keith Law is with us from ESPN tonight. You talk about Ricky Henderson and Tim Raines and how the stolen base can actually be a detriment to teams.
The idea of that chapter is that never look at one stat, especially accounting stat like stolen bases, don't look at it in isolation. In stolen bases, it's perfect because we have the foil right there, the caught stealing column, which is, it doesn't go back quite as far historically as stolen bases do, but for contemporary players, it's right there. And part of it was just to say, look, there's a cost. You attempt to steal. If you're successful, you've helped your chances of scoring a little bit. If you're unsuccessful, though, you have destroyed your chances of scoring that particular run. You've created another out. You only have three in innings. You've even further reduced your chances to score anything that inning by adding the out. It's not just deleting the base runner, but on top of that, creating another out. So the way the math works out, if you're not stealing successfully at above a certain threshold, right now I estimated it at about 71%. That's going to change a little bit year over year. I would say it's sort of off the cuff. If you're successful three times out of four as a single base stealer or as a team as a whole, if you're successful 75% of the time, you're probably doing fine. You're actually helping your team. If you're below 70%, stop running. You're actually making your offense worse.
Interesting. Very interesting. Now, you talk about the win stat for a pitcher, and you use the case of Hall of Famer Burt Blyleven,
who was a great, was absolutely Hall of Fame worthy, but took a long time to get into the Hall, despite the fact that his strikeout totals, the RA, some more advanced stats that we could talk about, that they all favored him going in. But the largest argument against him, the most prominent one, was that he never got to 300 wins, despite pitching for a very long time. And the reason he didn't get to 300 was that he spent almost his entire career on bad offensive clubs. Mm-hmm. He just didn't get the run support that many of his contemporaries got, including Don Sutton, who was an inferior pitcher, but did get to 300 wins because he played for better teams with better offenses. But that has nothing to do with a pitcher's performance. And I don't believe we should ever look at a player through the lens of what his were doing. If you're an effective pitcher, that has nothing to do with whether your team scored or didn't, and there's nothing you can do to make them score more. So when we're talking about pitchers, we should be trying to strip everything out, all the noise out of their stats, and look just at what they themselves did. The first thing you can strip out is run support. It's just irrelevant to talking about a pitcher's performance. And then in a later chapter, I talk about the difficulty that teams have in trying to pitching from defense, because the two are inextricably linked. This is run prevention. And there are a lot of different ways to go about it to try to isolate what a pitcher contributed himself versus what his defense might have contributed or taken away behind him.
Good. Okay. Now, let's go, touch on the Hall of Fame for a moment, Keith.
Mm-hmm.
There are some players, as we know, that were elected by the Veterans Committee and are there because they, quote-unquote, they know someone.
Right.
And we could think of one or two guys like that. There are guys that were voted in many years ago. Like, there's a guy named Roger Bresnahan, probably in the Hall of Fame because he invented the catcher's mask. And that's
right.
About it. let's hear some of the Hall of Famers that you don't agree with, and then we'll talk about some guys that should be in.
Well, recently we saw Bruce Sutter get in.
Right.
I think he's probably one of the worst selections. He might be the worst selection in the last 20 years. And he basically got in because he was the first closer, the first modern one-inning closer. That has nothing to do with him. It has to do with what his manager decided, how the manager decided to use him, the fact that he couldn't stay healthy doing anything else.
Right.
So he was a great pitcher in that role for about 5 years. His career was super short. He has fewer innings pitched than anyone else in the Hall. And that, to me, was a reason enough not to put him in. Jim Rice was the other one where he basically got in, I think, as a rebellion against people like myself arguing that we should be using better stats to look at players for the Hall of Fame. Jim Rice was not a Hall of Famer by any rational measure, but a number of sports writers argued that he was a feared hitter in his prime and therefore should be put in the Hall, despite the fact that his statistics did not come close to the standard for outfielders. In fact, I've argued he wasn't even the best outfielder on his own team. Dwight Evans
right.
A much better case for getting into the Hall, but for some reason Rice was the one the sports writers picked.
Right, and Dewey Evans garners very little interest, if any. Now, the one guy I kind of feel bad for, because I think he realizes that he doesn't belong there, he keeps a low profile, is Bill Mazeroski.
Yeah. He's a tough one because they say he doesn't belong. And a lot of people believe, and I think this is probably true, that he's in because of the home run. I mean, that's really, and I don't think I need to, where it's a New York station, I probably don't need to say anything more.
Well, actually, I believe, Keith, is that Joe Brown was on the Veterans Committee who owns the Pirates, and I think he got him in because there was a lot of cronyism during that time with the Veterans Committee.
Candy. Yeah.
Yeah. With Ted Williams getting in Bobby Doerr and trying to get Dominic in before he passed away, and a lot of that going on.
Yes. Oh, the Veterans is a mess, and I have a friend who's on it too, and he's not so much said that, but has confirmed that there's some politicking involved.
Yeah.
Too. But I, just to on Mazeroski, the one thing I'll say is, he, by every measure we have, even advanced stats say this was the best defensive second baseman in the history of the game. You know what? You want to put him in the Hall of Fame on that basis? I'm actually quite okay with that. A guy who played in the middle of the field and was by far the best defensive player in his position. That's actually a pretty good argument for me. The best shortstop was in anyway. Ozzie Smith
right.
killed in, and he absolutely deserved it.
There you
it.
Go, right.
I'm fine with putting Maz in for the, if that's the reason. I have a feeling that's not the reason. And I think you and I have both given two reasons that were a lot more prominent than advanced stats saying Maz was the best on defense.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And then if we look back far enough, there's a guy by the name of Rabbit Moranville.
Oh, yeah.
There's really,
he might be the worst.
I think his name got him in because it's unique.
Right.
You know. Other than that, I see no actual reason for Rabbit to be in the Hall of Fame.
If you look at his stats page, I would encourage anyone listening, just go look him up on Baseball Reference.
Right.
And you'll look and you'll say, that guy got in? How did that guy, like, there's no, it's so long ago, I don't know, was there a story, was there politicking, some kind of narrative, because there's no reason whatsoever he belongs in. And there's some dumb selections from the, especially from the integration era.
Yeah.
There were a lot of players in that era who just had no business being in. And it's, this is a broader Hall problem. Black players are still underrepresented. White players from before World War II are overrepresented because it was their, and that comes to what you just said. The Veterans Committee was all white guys, a bunch of whom were former players in that era. So they just politicked for their teammates. Nobody was really pounding the table for Negro Leaguers or even black players who were early in the integrated era and played in a pretty challenging environment, and I think a few more of whom probably deserve to get in.
Definitely, yeah. That's exactly true, Keith. Let's talk quickly about the RBI that you talk about, baseball's unreliable narrator.
Well, I use the Branch Rickey quote, which a lot of people have probably heard. RBIs aren't just misleading, they're dishonest. They are a function of how often you played and who hit ahead of you in the lineup. And if the two guys in front of you in the lineup get on base a ton, you're going to have a lot of RBIs even if you're not a very good hitter. And I pick on Joe Carter a little bit because he played a long time and he had the famous moment in the 93 World Series. And his RBI totals were generally great, but he wasn't a very good hitter. He was a truly impatient hitter with a lot of years with on-base percentages below or right around 300, which is really unacceptable just about any era now. Yet he would keep knocking in runs because I believe in San Diego he hit behind Roberto Alomar, who put up or something on base percentage. In fact, I think it was Alomar and Gwynn, going off memory here, but I believe that's who hit ahead of him. Well, you put those two guys ahead of just about anyone, they're going to get 100 RBIs because they're getting so many opportunities.
Right.
And in fact, for a chunk of Carter's career, because he was traded with Roberto Alomar to Toronto, he was consistently among the league leaders in just getting RBI opportunities. So, of course, he cashed a bunch of them in. If he couldn't do that, he wasn't going to be a major leaguer at all.
Yeah.
And if you judge him on his RBI totals, he looks like someone who'd get maybe a little Hall of Fame consideration. But if you judge him on the rest of his stat line, the stuff that doesn't come from his teammates, you realize he's not even close.
Right. Now, we could go on and on with the information in this book, Keith. It's been a pleasure having you with us tonight. I thank you for taking the time out of your Sunday night to be with us. The book, again, Smart Baseball, the story behind the old stats that are ruining the game, the new ones that are running it, and the right way to think about baseball. Thanks for being with us, Keith.
My pleasure.
Have a good evening. Keith Law, folks. Well, that'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Don McLean and Keith Law, my engineer, Brian Graves, and you, of course, for joining us on this Mother's Day. Stay tuned for hour number two on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you next Sunday, May 21st, with former Mets and Cards pitcher and outfielder, Rick Ankiel. Till then, Bill Donahue, wishing you a good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.